This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow night, Arts Build here in Chattanooga will host the presentation of this year's Ruth Holmberg Arts Leadership Award. The event takes place at the Hunter Museum starting at 6 p.m. James McKissick is president of Arts Build. James, thanks for joining us. Welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me back.
Tell us more about the award.
Well, the award is to honor a person in the Chattanooga community who represents arts leadership and arts philanthropy. And this year, the award is going to Candy Crucy, who many people will know, who's a great philanthropist and volunteer, a person who supports the arts in Chattanooga, who's supported the Hunter, the Symphony, String Theory. And not only does she support the arts, she encourages other people to support the arts financially and as volunteers as well.
Tell us more about some things that she has uniquely contributed to this area.
She helped to start String Theory. She's been involved in lots of different organizations. As I said earlier, she's definitely volunteered with the Hunter, the Symphony, even Mark Making, which is an organization that lots of people would know that's founded and doing work in East Chattanooga. She co-chaired the Make Work Grants program, and she also did a lot with arts education and the Development Arts Task Force in Education for Arts Build.
So you've worked with her on a lot of things, I'm sure.
Well, I have, and she's always been one of the people that I've seen around town who has always been very cordial to me, who has been like a role model in the arts and in philanthropy for me. In fact, she recently has gotten a financial commitment from me for an arts project in Chattanooga. She has a great way of doing things like that and making it happen.
Role models and peer-to-peer relationships, they are so crucial to support the arts.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's one reason why this award is named after Ruth Holmberg, who was probably the template for being an incredible arts supporter in Chattanooga.
Tell me what Ruth Holmberg means to you.
Well, for me, as a younger person coming up in the community and beginning to engage in the arts, Ruth Holmberg was like a constant presence. I would see her at different events, speak to her from time to time. She would open up her home and invite people in for arts purposes or to raise money for the arts from time to time. So she was an example of what a great arts philanthropist looked like for me. She is one of the people that I kind of think back to, along with people that made ways for me, like Jim Hill or Lily Wills, people that kind of opened doors for me. But Ruth was one of those, and she was also a great friend of Candy. And, you know, so it's great that Candy is receiving this award that's in her namesake. She was just always someone who I found very encouraging and an example of how you can support the arts. You can be a philanthropist with your time, your money, your resources, and really also with anything that you have that you can offer to the arts and to supporting the arts.
For her, the arts was not just about the arts, but it was about the community. It was about civic engagement.
It was
about building a better Chattanooga for all.
Exactly. And, you know, we can look back to work and things that she did to help further civil rights in Chattanooga. So it wasn't just the arts. It was lots of other things, too. But it was about making Chattanooga and helping Chattanooga to be one of those great communities, as we like to say now, where people want to live, work, and play.
Ruth Holmberg's unique contribution, just as you are about to celebrate Candy Crucy's unique contribution. Neither of those unique contributions could happen all by themselves. It takes a lot of partnerships.
And we could not put on an event like this at the Hunter, which is one of our wonderful partners and a place that I love for sure. But we could not put on an event like this without the support of sponsors. And this event this year is sponsored by First Horizon, the Chattanooga Times Free Press, and the Danina UBS Group.
So since our last conversation, you've been able to settle in a little bit more in your new role at Arts Build. How are things going?
Well, I'm really enjoying it. The team at Arts Build has been wonderful in helping me get situated, helping to educate me about the different elements of the job and of the work and the arts community that I'm not familiar with here in Chattanooga. And we're doing some great things working and bringing in some new fellows who are going to go into the arts organizations throughout the city and start working our opportunity fellows. We just met with a group of arts organizations and talked about board diversity and how we can try to further that in Chattanooga. So we're doing lots of great things, exciting things. And just stay tuned and we'll continue to do that.
And where can people go online for more information about the reception and everything going on at Arts Build?
www.artsbuild.com to find out about the reception and also anything that Arts Build is doing in the community.
All right, James, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Next, three encore conversations from our past few shows. Tim Kelly can tell you about how numbers are the language of business, what he calls the numbers game. He is the owner of Kelly Subaru Downtown here in Chattanooga and co-founder of the Chattanooga Football Club. Tim shares his experience and insights about entrepreneurship and small business finance wherever he goes, from a lunch at the incubator to stopping by Scenic Roots. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the numbers game.
Well, it came about from a conversation I had with Alexis Willis, who's the director at the BDC, about the need for really kind of basic economic literacy and familiarity with Excel as a tool for startups, because there are a lot of people in entrepreneurship who, you know, everybody's got a concept and it tends to be sort of an idea thing. And numbers, very frankly, are often boring to those people. But there's obviously nothing more important. I think where a lot of startups get tripped up is trying to tell a story through numbers.
And numbers can tell a story, but numbers can also bury a story that you're trying to tell.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was Disraeli who famously said that there are lies, damn lies, and statistics, right? So they can. They always tell a story, and it takes somebody smart to be able to sort of decipher the story. And bankers are very good at that. So it's a form of literacy. It's critically important. And no startup goes very far without knowing their way around numbers. But it's pretty shocking, really, how many people, particularly at the BDC, which often houses people like just at the concept stage and trying to get rolling, how often they don't have somebody on their team who really knows their way around a spreadsheet and how to tell that story.
What's one misconception that startups have when it comes to numbers?
That it always costs more than they think, right? Expenses creep. And we like to say, you know, expenses are forever and revenues are conjectural. So nobody ever gets it right from the beginning, right? You have to kind of look at things in terms of a sensitivity analysis and what you hope will happen. But one of the qualities of entrepreneurship tends to be, for lack of a better term, perhaps irrational optimism. You know, I mean, again, that's the nature of risk capital. But a lot of times that causes you to see things through rose-colored glasses. And I should say very, very seldom does one person possess both those sort of classic entrepreneurial qualities and the leaven qualities of kind of a CPA, right? So every startup has to find that person to kind of keep them grounded in financial reality.
And you talk about irrational optimism. That can certainly come into play in an area such as this where startups are legendary, startups are booming. Let me get in on that, not worry about numbers so much.
That's exactly right. And look, it's important in a weird way. It is, the famous economist Joseph Schumpeter talked about creative destruction. You know, startups fail at a pretty alarming pace, and they always have and they always will. So somebody has to be willing to be, frankly, a little irrational. You know, every great idea started out with, I mean, Fred Smith, the guy that started FedEx, famously was turned down by many, 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 you know, I think he flunked in business school and was turned down by tons of venture capital firms before he started. You have to have the vision, but the trick is determining the difference between vision and delusion. And again, very frankly, that's where numbers come in.
Between Kelly Subaru and CFC, what have you learned about the numbers game along the way?
Oh, plenty. It is a form of gambling and bet hedging. And you've got to be able to do what you say you're going to do. And you got to be able to make intelligent wagers with numbers. And you've got to be able to, if you're going to, depending on where you're going to get the money to start the business, If you're going to get it from a bank, you need to tell the story in a certain way. If you're going to get it from investors, you need to tell the story in a slightly different way. Equity and debt are two different things with two different priorities and returns. And so, gosh, we don't have enough time to go through all the things I've learned. You know, I've had a couple of businesses that failed because it, you know, didn't pan out for one reason or the other. And of course, the economy sometimes cooperates and it doesn't. And so, again, anybody that spent any time in entrepreneurship will tell you that you learn more from your failures than you do from your successes.
Give me your take on what it's been like running an auto business in this area for as many years as you have.
Wow. Yeah, it's hard to believe I'm now officially old. This is my 30th year in the business, and it's been crazy. It's been up and down and all over the place. In the retail car business, you're very much, your success is more determined by the wagon you're hitched to, really, than your own virtuosity running the business. So if you're lucky enough to be attached to a really great brand, very frankly, that has more to do with success. And that's why at one time I thought what I was supposed to be doing was accumulating as many car brands as I could. I had a bunch. And after the GM bankruptcy in 2007, that was very, very difficult. We lost a couple of dealerships. General Motors was not in great shape financially, obviously, because it had to file bankruptcy. And so we lost some stores. We closed some stores. Was lucky enough. At that point, I went back to business school and really hadn't. I mean, I was a comparative literature major in college. Hmm. And so learned what I knew about business just on the car lot and around the lot. Post the GM bankruptcy, went back to Emory to get my MBA and picked up a tremendous amount of knowledge on finance, and then realized that I really should be focusing on the businesses that were super successful, in this case, Subaru. Subaru was a great brand that really began to turn the corner and take off during, ironically, during the recession, and had, you know, sales growth year over year during the worst economy in my lifetime. And so I kind of jettisoned the other stuff and really put my eggs in that basket, mainly on the automotive front. And it's been great. Subaru is a really great brand, making a really great product, and continues to be great.
What are your thoughts about supply chains? We're hearing that again in the news because of, unfortunately, coronavirus.
Yeah, the whole kind of just-in-time method of really squeezing waste out of a supply chain has the unfortunate Achilles heel of being very vulnerable to shocks and disruptions. We saw that through financial disruption in 07. Famously, I think there was one plant in China that made some particular chemical for black paint, and it shut down. Ford couldn't make black pickup trucks for 6 or 8 weeks because of that one little disruption in the supply chain. And I think since then, most major companies have really attempted to build in some redundancy and a little bit more fat, a little bit less brutal leanness. But I think we're going to find out the coronavirus is already disrupting supply chains in a major way out of China, and I guess it will continue to do so. So it's definitely going to put a damper on world GDP growth.
And speaking of supply chains, but from a different angle,
yep,
Chattanooga is part of the supply chain in more ways than one. And you've seen that evolve over the past 30 years.
Yes, I have. Yeah. What would you like to know about that?
Well, just talk about that experience.
Well, yeah, it's been an interesting deal. You know, Chattanooga's home to a lot of suppliers. And obviously with VW coming here in 09, that supplier base grew. And it continues to grow with automotive companies relocating to the Southeast. And I think it's a great opportunity for the local area. So it continues to be an area where dollar stability and world disease notwithstanding, our area is really a pivotal area to at least specifically the automotive supply chain globally. And what VW has done, I'm not sure everybody really realizes, VW with their investments in Chattanooga, I don't think it's too strong a statement to say they will be a real rival to Tesla. They're doubling down on the electric market. And so that comes with a whole different supply chain and metric, and I think shipping cars worldwide. So it's a very big deal for our area.
How did you decide to launch CFC?
Well, it wasn't really my decision. There were a couple of guys who had the concept before me and pulled me into it as, there were 8 co-founders originally, really 9, and we all kind of had the same vision. The original guys were Thomas Clark, who had played soccer down in Birmingham and was new to the area, Crew Brock and Errol Heald. I went to church with Thomas and heard the idea and thought it was great. And VW actually was part of it because they were coming to town and they had a long reputation for support for the sport. And a mutual friend of ours was Sheldon Grizzle, who called me up and knew that I knew Frank Burke, who was at the time running Finley Stadium under contract. And I knew a lot about sponsorships and other stuff. So we all kind of brought a different skill set to the table. And gosh, the discussion started in February, early February of that year, as I recall. And in May, we had a team on the field. It was a classic startup in many respects. We just kind of scraped it together and did it, and it took off like a shot.
Who would have thought you would have had a team like that around 20, 25 years ago?
I couldn't have imagined. And it's really been probably the most gratifying thing I've done in a pretty, in a pretty varied career in business, because to take something that was literally just a clean sheet of paper startup and grow it into not only a successful brand and team, largely with the help of another co-founder, Paul Rustand, who's our brand director and does a fantastic job there, but really it's become a model for grassroots community soccer around the United States. Teams in Detroit and Asheville and Little Rock and Savannah and a lot of other cities were directly inspired by us. And Oakland Roots were all directly inspired by what we've done here. And then the community ownership piece, which became possible after the Jobs Act in 2016, was also really groundbreaking. We're super proud of that. And hopefully that model will spread around the country as well.
And community ownership, I just think back, because I'm from the upper Midwest originally.
Yep.
I think back to the Green Bay Packers.
That was our direct inspiration. I distinctly remember we were having a beer with some of the early Chattahooligans after our first season wrapped up. And there was an attorney named John Meldorf who said, you really ought to, wouldn't that be great? And Crew Brock and I said, that would be great. That would be amazing. We would love to do that. The weird little insight is it's not common in American sports, because most of American sports teams are owned by billionaires who want to be able to pick up the team and move it if they don't get what they want or get a stadium deal or for whatever reason. Look at what just happened in Oakland with the Raiders. I mean, it's unthinkable, right? If you're a Raiders fan from Oakland. But the European, really the worldwide model of soccer is completely different, right? The teams are place-based. And we said from the beginning, we're place-based. We baked it into the name. We're Chattanooga FC. We always will be. And so if you accept that conjecture, then why would you not be community-owned, right? And Green Bay is the same way, right? Interestingly, the NFL banned community ownership in the early 70s, so there'll never be another Green Bay, because the billionaires really don't like that idea at all. So it's weird because it's subversive in the American context, but it's commonplace in the world context.
Maybe they also didn't like Vince Lombardi winning so much.
That could be it. Yeah, that might have had something to do with it. Just bitterness and revenge, probably.
In your experience with CFC, what did you find carried over well from the auto business, and what was a brand new learning curve?
What carried over well was marketing, right? Marketing is marketing is marketing. You have to tell a story and get people excited and get them to buy into it. And whether that's a story about a brand or a car, or that's a story about a team and a game, it's about being able to create narratives and express narratives and find the proper media channels to do that through. So we had great chemistry early on with, like I said, Paul Rustin and other members of our founding board who were able to bring that together and do it in a pretty compelling way, I think. Sheldon Grizzle in particular was younger than the rest of us and really brought, this was the early days of Facebook where everybody had like 100 Facebook friends, right? And we discovered pretty quickly, wow, there are a lot of soccer fans out there who just were kind of closet soccer fans. And so social media had a lot to do with it. But marketing really is a common thread there. What was new and completely different is that sports teams, particularly CFC, which operates as a benefit corp, really are not there to rack up profits for shareholders. We hope we make a couple of bucks at the end of a season, but typically, and this is well established by a famous professor of sports in Michigan named Stefan Szymanski, who wrote a great book called Soccernomics, if you really are interested in the subject, but typically sports teams will compete away their profits to buy better players. So, our player payroll is X, and if we make a little money, we're probably going to take that money and go try to buy a little bit better players next year rather than return surplus. That's pretty different, right? In private business, what you're trying to do is maximize ROI. But Chattanooga FC is really as much a community institution as it is a business, so it's pretty different that way.
Good to give back.
Yeah, absolutely. And it has, we really see soccer as an ecosystem. So there's the benefit corp that runs the team. There's also a foundation side with a different board and leadership, but common themes and goals and missions. There's an academy with its own board, but common themes. And they all have sub-initiatives that really sort of tie together, but it's very much about community in the deepest sense of the word. The purpose of the club from day one was to use soccer as a tool to build community. That's in the club's mission statement.
And all raring to go for 2020.
Absolutely. Yep.
All right. Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment. This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. A maritime risk management firm with a footprint here in Chattanooga is tracking how the coronavirus is affecting shipping traffic for clients at sea around the world. International Maritime Security Associates is based in Florida, but a few years ago, it opened its data center and software operations in the city. Frank Fenner, the firm's co-founder, stopped by Scenic Roots.
Frank, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Ray, it's a pleasure for me to be here with you.
How does a company such as yours track maritime traffic at a time like this?
There's a couple of dilemmas that come into play with maritime traffic. There is systems out there that track ships at sea, but none that bring the information to the bridge of a vessel that we do. So we've developed a platform that's called ARMS, and ARMS brings critical information to a ship at sea. And we look at a couple of different categories. And one right now that's really within the news spectrum is disease and health. And that being with the coronavirus that's out there, we've seen an uptick in how that's affected the whole maritime traffic, port closures, those types of things, or just even delays that could cost overruns that end up into the supply chain. But also people that are interacting with it and getting this virus. There's a ship that's over in Japan right now that's in quarantine, around 3,000 people on the ship, but about 750 had contracted the coronavirus.
And of course, a lot of that shipping traffic either comes from or goes through China.
Yeah, definitely. Since China is the largest supplier of goods around the world, how they've set themselves up over the last 100 plus years goes back a little bit further than that. But with what we're doing now with such a global market, world reach, sometimes these types of things would have never had the impact that it does today. But now there's an uptick in Italy, in France, and other countries that are really seeing an increase in this virus.
Now, IMSA is based in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, but it has a footprint here in Chattanooga.
Well, so that's the unique part about what we do as a company. We looked at regulatory compliance and safety and security for both ships and ports. That's how we started the company. And then we've seen this need for actionable information for a ship. And we knew doing that in South Florida, it could be done, but the cost of doing it would have been a little bit higher than it would be doing it elsewhere possibly. And the other side is that we needed to have a great big pipeline to get information flow. We didn't necessarily have to be close to water. And so when we started evaluating different cities, we looked at five different factors. And one in two of those was having great fiber and great power. Then outside of major weather, outside of like a 9/11 type incident again, and then just the quality of life, cost of living. And when you put all five of those factors in the bag, you pull out a name, you get Chattanooga, Tennessee. So in 2015, we came up here, we did a little research of the city, and in 2016, we pulled the trigger. We set up a corporation here as a secondary operating company from our parent company in Florida. And now in doing so, we've been a part of the CoLab and what they've done with their gig tech accelerator. We also do work right here with UTC, with the Sim Center, and Dr. Tony Shellam over there been a huge support. We've actually won a grant that's come through UTC via Oak Ridge Labs with some of the things that we're doing in data collection and how we store that data. They're really a great support in advancing the technology, both Dr. Shellam, Dr. Condit, and others that are part of that team when we're there at the Sim Center.
You recently launched a platform that provides real-time data to ships beyond what they've had before. Explain how that works.
Let me go back a little bit and say, hey, this is how ships used to get their information, or actually still do get their information. But we've seen the discrepancy of how things were done. And both myself, I was in the Navy, and my business partner, Corey, was in the Coast Guard. And Corey actually spent a lot more time on ships than I did. And one of the problems that he always seen when he was out there working in the Coast Guard is this lack of information that would get to them. The only ways of communication was maybe a satellite phone, maybe an email, or maybe the next port that you pull into that you get some sort of direct that is given to you. So right now there's a system that on every vessel that's over 200 metric tons, and that system is called the GMDSS. What happens though is every ship gets this information that happens everywhere around the world. And if you're in the Atlantic, you're not really worried about what's happening in the Pacific. And it literally comes in a textual type format, and then you have to go over to your chart and plot it on your chart and see where it's at. Well, what our system does and what we've done here in Chattanooga, we've set up what we call our I2C, Intel and Information Center. And we have people that are there 24/7 operating, looking at different rests from port and canal delays, civil unrest in and around a port, and obviously health epidemics that could be happening around the world. And then there's some other ones that we look at. And we say our real-time window is every 10 minutes because the fact that ships aren't traveling at an exponential speed that's somewhere between 8 and 12 knots that they're navigating the world. So every 10 minutes, our platform that rests on the bridge of the ship interacts. And what we like to say is it's a Waze traffic app for ships at sea at a greater granular level, or on steroids, as sometimes we say.
And how does this situation compare to other situations that this platform has monitored?
We're constantly monitoring things. So we've even seen things with migrancy. And one of the things we don't do, we don't command or control any ship. What we're trying to do is provide the best information available to the decision makers so they can decide, hey, do we need to go to a different port? Do we need to look at how we interact with shoreside personnel? And those are the things. They set their protocols. We give some guidance in that if they request it, but we'd never try to sit there and say, this is what you need to do or what you don't need to do. But we want to give them critical information to make the best decision possible.
What's something that people might not know about shipping and the work that companies such as yours do?
One of the biggest things that people don't realize, 90% of what we use daily has a lifetime on the ocean at some point. And that's the biggest thing that people don't realize, that of the really the world is connected by ships. Even though things get flown by air freight and everything like that, the cost of doing that is 10-20x versus floating something across on the water. And the other thing is there's been a new expansion of the Panama Canal within the last 5 years, and now we're able to get Panamax ships in. Now the problem for that on our side now is we went from container ships that were 7 to 12,000, and now some of these can go up to upwards of 20,000. The infrastructure that exists at the ports doesn't have the resources to move these containers in and out at an efficient level yet. We're getting there, but we're a little bit behind on that side. And we believe that what our platform does will help in that whole just-in-time shipping. And the other side that we didn't realize being here in Chattanooga was the logistical community. We were naive or just uneducated in regards to what Chattanooga had as far as the logistical community, and then other companies like FreightWaves moving forward and providing that into their side of the shipping world and tractor trailer as well.
All right, Frank, thanks so much.
Hey, it was a pleasure to be here, Ray. We really appreciate it.
Morris Mitchell is an award-winning artist here in Chattanooga. He graduated from the Ringling College of Art and Design in Sarasota, Florida, and taught there for 42 years. Morris specializes in mixed media art, and recently his work was featured in this area in a gallery show titled Pioneering the Edge. When Morris dropped by Scenic Roots a while back, he shared his story and the questions he raises through his art.
Morris, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell me how you were drawn to art.
Probably as a child, when I saw other artists and what they could do, I was stuck. early on, although I listened to too many people early on that I shouldn't be an artist, this or that or whatever. Finally, I decided to hell with everybody else. I said, I'm going to do my own thing. And I went to art school and taught there for 42 years at the Ringling College of Art and Design in Sarasota, Florida. Was chairman of fine arts for 9 years.
And tell us more about your art.
My work is a mixture of many things. I was trained as a classical artist, the old masters. Rembrandt was my favorite, Vermeer, Goya. But I was smitten by the New York School of Painters, 50s, 60s, and 70s, de Kooning, Poussette d'Art, a number of other painters. Lee Bontecue is a woman, probably my favorite female artist of the 20th century. They're some of the greats in painting and sculpture.
When it comes to painting and when it comes to printmaking, which I understand you also do.
Yes, sir.
What are some of the themes you touch on?
Well, on many levels, I draw from everything. Early on, I was taught by my mentor and dear friend until he died, everything you create should be an individual experience. I call myself a seeker, a searcher. I'm interested in everything. And so it varies from religion or spirituality, better yet, to intellectual approach as well as emotional. All of that, I'm interested in the world culture, what's happening today and yesterday. I love teaching. I think the teaching taught me as much as I hope I conveyed to the students every minute.
What's your take on world culture as it's unfolded during your lifetime?
Well, I was brought up as sort of in a glass bubble, I guess you could say. I was taught that this country is a great democracy, and I lived in a beautiful country with beautiful people. I loved nature and everything around me. I loved people gave me and still do. As that progressed, I've become confused and bewildered with the political situation today. That concerns me greatly. I love my country more than anybody that I can think of. I mean, but I have been jaded by, I think, the facts that the country has divided it almost in half. It troubles me greatly. I have always taught and lived and created within, I guess, the boundaries of beauty, love, cherishing everything was around us. Today, so many things are negative and jaded.
And it doesn't matter in terms of polarization, which tribe we're talking about either.
Right, right. Oh yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So my work is, I think, all over the place. Each piece that I do is an individual search or research. It's heartfelt. I try to be very honest. I still look for the beauty in people and nature and animals and try to bring that about. There are several pieces in the exhibition. One's called Jacob's Ladder. Another one is called Eden. And then there's another one which I had just finished called Truth and Reason. And today, people wear masks. And I look for the time we go back to truth and reason and approach life looking for the better things.
You've also created art starting at a time where there was electronic media, but that has vaulted into another constellation in the past generation and especially the past decade to a dozen years.
That's true.
And how people look at art or whether they should look at art.
Because a lot of people that can't or don't or haven't been taught to read art. Art is not just a picture. I like to think of it as the great artists, whether it be today or in the past, Caravaggio, Rembrandt, whatever, dug much deeper into the individuals, sought to get beneath things. When I started as a portrait artist when I was early on in life, I wanted not only to get a good likeness, but to get inside of them. So the beauty or the sadness or whatever it was, portray that into the painting. That takes a lot more. And so many people today, well, it's a quick fix. It's a picture, and they move on. They don't go into a museum or a gallery and look at it and develop a dialogue with that piece to glean not only what is there, but much deeper.
Why the Chattanooga area?
Well, it's interesting. The political situation in higher education got to me in my latter years. The education had changed. I'm deeply involved with really trying to plant a seed with students and see them blossom, as well as in my own art and student art. And not superficiality or the reflect quick fixes of the time. Situation in Sarasota, Florida, where we lived for all those years, was changing the culture. It was becoming departmentalized, I think. It was different than when I arrived there originally. So when I had retired at one time, and then 3 years later, they conned me into coming back to school and teaching two more years. And at the end of the 2 years, I said to my wife, "What do you think about leaving Sarasota?" And she said, "I'm ready." And so we went looking. I thought I was going to go to Knoxville. We came here first, and I really liked it. It was a big town, but it had a small town feeling. Spiritually, it was comfortable for me. And I felt it had a life that was growing. I felt part of that growth. So we went on to Knoxville, didn't like it. We were going to go to South Carolina. I said, "No, let's go back to Chattanooga, take a look at it." And we came back here, and I fell in love with it. I love the people. I love the terrain. And I felt like I was finally at home. And I feel that today.
And how long have you and your wife been here?
About 16 years. Yeah, I think 16 years.
Besides your art, another thing that you're involved with here is mark making.
Yes, I was involved with mark making. Francis McDonald, who has remained a very dear friend of mine, somebody who I love very much. I liked working with underserved, the mentally and physically challenged. I love the idea of trying to bring people up and help them see the beauty and the glory of the world around them when there's so much strife and so on going on. It was a pleasure. I was on her board for about 7 years.
And tell us what art you do now.
Most of the work range from spirituality to culture commentation or just personal intimate visions or thoughts that I have that challenge me. I've always loved challenges in the classroom as well as in the work itself. I really believe good work and the masters, be they contemporary or in the past, got inside of life and sought answers. I'm always seeking answers. I think of my work as more questions than immediate or momentary answers. I'm always like to challenge the viewer, to make them think, to make them dream, take them somewhere else.
Do you find this season of your life staring back at you in any way as you are thinking about and making the art that you're doing now in wrestling with some of these questions, this constant wrestling with questions?
I want people to think. I'm a great thinker. I am not computer literate. By choice. I tell a little story. The school that I was working at, a class for those who hadn't become computer literate. And I took the first class, And my wife said, oh, I can teach you that. And so I had a day with her. And the next day, I went into her office, and the computer blew up. Smoke came out of it. I said, that's an omen. I like to think that I'm a thinker, a searcher, a finder. I look for truths. I believe that all of my work tries to open doors, hopefully uplifting or challenging or thought-provoking visions, ideas. I'm an image maker. There are two languages, the written word and the graven image. I'm definitely a graven image person.
And where can people go online to see your work?
Yes, morrismitchell.com. My email is momart, M-O-E-M-A-R-T, at comcast.net.
All right. Morris, yeah. Thanks so much.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. Great pleasure.
You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. Our show is produced by Haley Solomon, Carly Dodson, and Will Davis from the studios of WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Follow us on Twitter at scenicroots423 and email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Also, follow WUTC on Facebook and Instagram and listen online anytime at wutc.org and the WUTC app. Join us again next time for Scenic Roots.